Cross Section USA with Dwight Cook. CBS and its affiliated stations present another cross-country visit with our neighbors as a group of the USA's largest national organizations join CBS for these weekly reports. And every Saturday at this same time, spokesmen for millions of our neighbors in farming, labor, and business bring us their recommendations for action on the urgent issues which will shape our jobs and our future security. Cross Section USA with Dwight Cook.
Good afternoon. Here in Washington, as I'm sure you know, the cherry trees are in full bloom against today's clear blue and sunny sky. But the men of responsibility here in Washington haven't had much chance this week to enjoy those cherry trees, for both the White House and the executive departments and up on the Hill in Congress, these men are faced with the same difficult question we all are. How much defense does the USA need now? Last week, Cross Section discussed this from the point of view of men for defense, of universal military training and an emergency draft. Today we'll go around the USA and hear from leading experts and official spokesmen of top national organizations in which millions of our neighbors are joined. We'll ask them to give us their recommendations for action in the whole area of money for defense. In other words, how much money should we spend for what kinds of defense? Many figures have been flying around Washington just as highly colored as the cherry blossoms. But boiled down to official request to Congress, the President and the armed forces say we should spend about $15 billion this year. That includes the regular Army, Navy, and Air budgets, the cost of UMT the first year, and the cost of a draft to raise our forces to about 2 million men. But that $15 billion, and it's almost as much as we plan to spend on the whole Marshall Plan in the next 4 years, that $15 billion may be only a beginning. There's talk in Washington today of the need of up to $2 billion for military lend-lease to Western Europe. And what about enlarging the air forces from 55 to 70 or more groups? Mr. Forrestal thinks that might cost us another $15 billion. So in this confusion of fears and figures, Cross-Section asks our guests, what's the score? How much money do we need to spend for what kind of defenses right now? And can we spend such sums without a new inflation which could wreck us all? For the first of our quick and informal answers to that question, we'll turn to the recommendations of the USA's largest organization of labor unions, the American Federation of Labor. Since the AFL's headquarters are here in Washington, we'll stay here for their official spokesman, and Bob Lewis of WTOP will ask the question, so go ahead, Bob.
Well, thanks very much, Dwight, and to get this discussion moving, I'll ask Mr. Keenan first how he'd vote for the president's budget if he were a member of Congress.
I would vote for it.
You'd vote for the $15 billion?
Yes, sir.
Or would you vote for more than that?
I would if with reasonable facts that we needed it.
Well, would you go up to $25 billion, to $50
billion? I would go to whatever amount was necessary to maintain this kind of government. Now, I think that somewhere along the line, we must come to a point, how much is this kind of government that we love so much worth? And I think in the past, we went up to almost $100 billion in order to maintain it. And I certainly would invest $50 billion if it was necessary to maintain it.
Well, if you would invest this $50 billion, then what would you spend it? Would you spend it all on air, or would you spend it on atomic bombs, or on jet propulsion, or UMT, or what?
Well, no, I would certainly have it spent in such a way that it would meet the requirements due to the experiences, the services brought to us as to the kind of weapons our enemies would be developing and using. I think that war is a fluctuating thing. It changes overnight. And in order to meet the requirements, we would have to have developed any new type of device that was used against us.
In other words, airplanes, jet propulsion, and all that, you would increase.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm thinking of atomic energy. The budget this year calls for about $500 million. Would you double that? Would you triple it?
I certainly would. I think today that the atomic bomb is the only reason that we're in the position that we're in. I think if the tables were turned and if the Russian had the atomic bomb instead of us, that they today would be demanding certain things that we could not defend ourselves against, and we should pray to the Lord that we had foresight enough to develop it and have it today as a safeguard against any kind of an offensive. by the Russians or any other country.
Well, Mr. Keenan, what kind of a yardstick would you use in weighing these requirements as set forth by the military as opposed to the other people? In other words, how would you arrive at a decision on how much you'd vote for?
Well, of course, here in this country, we have spent billions of dollars in our Naval Academy and at West Point for the purpose of developing people to set up our military organizations and to set up whatever defenses are necessary. Now, they're the only source that we have today to depend upon.
Our admirals and generals.
Now, when the chiefs of staff come in with a figure, up to the present, we, as civilians, can raise a protest. But when they give you all of the information, as a civilian, you're afraid to go only to a certain point. Now, if we're not satisfied with this kind of a procedure, then I feel that we must develop a civilian, non-political organization and train them, the same as you do your admirals and your generals, as a check or a balance against whatever the demands of the military may be.
All right. What about such things as prices and wages and taxes if we have a budget up to $25 billion?
Well, of course, you then must come upon some kind of controls.
Controls.
I think that you must control prices,
wages.
And it'll be necessary to control wages. But I think you have to put controls all across the board.
You would put that as part of the defense program?
If we come to a shooting war, yes, sir.
You absolutely control it, and you would vote for that along with your expenses?
Absolutely. From experience, I find that when we have the military drawing off all of the civilian supplies, and we come upon a great scarcity, if we don't have some kind of controls, you're just bound to have runaway inflation.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Keenan. That was Joseph D. Keenan, assistant to the executive secretary of the AFL's Political Education League. And, Dwight, that's all of the AFL's position for defense.
Thanks, Bob Lewis. And I must say also thank you to Mr. Keenan, because for a nice, frank, clear, quick, and informal answer to some very difficult questions, I don't think you could ask for a clearer statement of where an organization stands than Mr. Keenan just gave us. Now, as cross-section continues our survey on what we should spend for what kinds of defense, Mr. Keenan has said, in effect, we should spend the works for whatever is necessary, we'll jump across the country for two West Coast pickups, one in San Francisco with the official spokesman for the Chamber of Commerce, the USA's largest organization of businessmen, and one in Los Angeles with a spokesman for the International Association of Machinists, one of the USA's largest independent labor unions. First to KQW in San Francisco, where Carol Hansen is waiting with his guest. Give us 5 seconds to throw a lot of switches in control rooms around the country, and we'll continue this cross-section on the West Coast.
Well, Dwight, out here in San Francisco, Mr. Dunlap C. Clark and myself have been listening attentively to the AFL's Mr. Keenan. And I think our guest, Mr. Clark, is certainly qualified to discuss the question of money for defense. He's not only a director of the United States Chamber of Commerce and chairman of its Committee on National Defense, but he's a banker, the president of the Central Bank in Oakland. Well, Mr. Clark, how did you agree with Mr. Keenan's ideas?
Mr. Hansen, personally, I'm very much pleased at the very sound attitude expressed by Mr. Keenan, and in the main, I go along with him 100%.
How about the various amounts of money that he suggested as to atomic energy and that sort of thing?
Well, that's rather difficult to come actually down to dollars and cents. It seems somewhat questionable to me how anyone outside of the Department of National Defense and the Congress can attempt to evaluate in dollars and cents how much should be spent now. There's been too much careless and carping criticism unjustly accusing the armed forces of always asking too much money. And I'm very happy that Mr. Keenan did not take that attitude. It should be realized that money spent now, calmly in peacetime, will buy far more materiel than under the pressure of forced procurement and production during the emergencies of war. Incidentally, Mr. Hansen, during World War II, I served as a colonel on the War Department General Staff under the budget officer for the War Department, and therefore I know from experience how carefully the budget estimates of the different branches of the service are screened and boiled down before submission to the Congressional Appropriations Committees.
I see. Now, Mr. Clark, what is the Chamber of Commerce's attitude on national defense spending?
Well, the policy declarations of the Chamber of Commerce have always stressed the desirability of maintenance and development of adequate national defense in peacetime. One sentence from a current declaration to be adopted at our annual meeting in Washington later this month epitomizes the attitude very well, I think, and I quote, "We hope that adequate appropriations at this time to the several purposes of national security may produce a tremendous saving in the foreseeable future in the outlay of our national treasure and the lives of our people." And don't overlook that, and the lives of our people.
Well, now, Mr. Clark, speaking as a banker now and not as a Chamber of Commerce official, how much do you think should be spent for national defense?
Well, as I remarked earlier, I wouldn't attempt to evaluate that, but I would certainly follow along very closely with the recommendations made by these gentlemen who have spent their lives in studying the requirements of national defense, namely those who are now the top men in our Department of National Defense.
Well, now, is there any place where this money should be spent other than for military needs? And by that, I mean for research, propaganda, for government subsidies, such as the aircraft industry and that sort of thing?
Yes, of course, that is taken account of in our whole national defense program. Aside from the uses of manpower, you have your research and development program, you have your industrial mobilization of industry, and then again, you have your selective service, which has been proposed, and the possibility of universal military training.
Well, what's all this going to do to our national economy? Is it going to bring back price controls and rationing in some forms?
Presumably, it might. It depends, again, on how much is spent and how rapidly that money flows into our whole civilian economy setup. Personally, I hope that it won't come so fast that we have to clamp down controls. But if we do, in order to achieve the objective of a strong national defense, then we will have to go along.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dunlap C. Clark, so much for coming up here this afternoon. Well, Dwight, that's about it from San Francisco. Let's go down the coast now to Stuart Novins at KNX in Los Angeles.
Dwight, I'd like you to meet a man from Los Angeles. He's Mr. Ernest White, who represents the International Association of Machinists.
Hello, Dwight. We in Southern California are certainly interested in this program, as this is the principal production center for the aircraft industry of this nation.
Well, Mr. White, just what is your opinion on the money to be spent for the draft, for universal military training, for that 70-group Air Force, or any of the other elements that were mentioned by Mr. Keenan and Mr. Clark a few moments ago?
Well, I certainly subscribe wholeheartedly to the statements of Brother Joe Keenan that we should spend as much money as is necessary to continue the form of government that we have at the present time. And I would certainly stress the need for industrial mobilization, particularly in industries that are right at the heart of our necessary production in the event of an emergency of the type that we are fearful of at this time.
Well, do you feel that the major emphasis of any money to be spent should be placed on industrial mobilization rather than on manpower?
I certainly do, because our power and ability to produce, our industrial capacity in this country, is one of our greatest natural assets, and I believe that we should certainly stress that productivity rather than stress the training of vast armies.
Well, from your experience, how long would you say it would take to produce an adequate Air Force, so far as the planes themselves were concerned, if we were to start right now?
Well, I met at first hand the production problems of our aircraft industry during the last war, and if our orders were placed today, it would be about 2 years before those planes could be produced in quantity if they were new type of airplanes.
Do you feel that there is an advantage to being in a production now rather than starting, say, with new production a couple of years from now or next year if the National Defense officers feel that it's necessary then?
Well, certainly a 70-group Air Force, and I'm not going to question the adequacy of that size, is going to need not only ships, but it's going to need replacements for the ships that they have. And if they are in production on ships at that time, you can rapidly convert to new ships and ships of different type if you're already in production.
You feel it's better to make the conversion if you're in production than to start from scratch at the time of a basic emergency?
Certainly, you can do it much more rapidly.
Well, now, you've placed the emphasis on industrial production rather than on men. To get away from aircraft for a moment, how do we shape up in other industrial fields?
Well, certainly our steel capacity is a bottleneck. It was a problem during the last war, and it isn't adequate at the present time to meet our civilian needs. And, of course, as long as steel is tight, Naturally, that's going to reflect on rolling stock for our railroads and other essential transportation facilities.
Would you recommend that some of the money to be spent should be spent in priming these basic industries rather than on manpower?
It certainly should be, and it should be well planned so that it's not wasted, but there should be an integrated, well-thought-out program of expediting our industrial mobilization.
Well, now, when all this money is poured into industry, as you recommend, won't that bring about an additional spurt to an inflationary spiral?
Well, I'm going to have to subscribe to the ideas of Brother Joe Keenan. If we reach that problem, we're certainly going to have some type of controls to hold it in balance.
How do you feel about bringing men, either through the draft or through UMT, into the service so they can take over these planes and equipment as they're being produced?
Well, of course, the average American young man is basically a pretty good mechanic, and our experience during the last war in training ground crews and bringing them into the factories so that they could observe at first hand the fabrication of the products with additional classroom training, supplemented by trained technical people from the factory themselves who examined the equipment under battle conditions, I believe functioned very effectively and is the normal approach to that problem.
Well, now, as a labor representative, doesn't that put you in the position of advocating underscale labor from military sources to compete with your own machinist union members?
Not exactly. We don't consider these boys as competition, and we're thinking as citizens from a standpoint of national defense.
Well, those are the opinions, Dwight, of Mr. Ernest White of the International Association of Machinists, who'll be waiting with me to hear your other guests after 5 seconds when we'll be back on the East Coast with Dwight Cook.
Well, if you wanted some clear and precise answers on what we ought to do about defense now, you couldn't ask for better than you've been getting so far from our guests on cross-section. You've heard an ex-vice chairman of the War Production Board speaking for the AFL, an ex-colonel in the Army Budget Department speaking for the Chamber of Commerce, and an aviation expert for the machinists. Now let's go on to the Middle West and see what the oldest organizations of farmers in the United States, the National Grange, has to say. Their official spokesman is waiting in Indianapolis with Harry Martin of WFBM. So, all right, Harry, take it away.
Well, thanks, Dwight. Here in Indianapolis, I've been sitting with Herschel D. Newsom, an Indiana farmer who is also the master of the Indiana Grange, and listening with a great deal of interest to the comments of your earlier guests. Mr. Newsom, would you tell us now, after listening to these comments, just how much money you think we should spend now for defense?
Harry, I'd like to agree with them in the one statement that they've made to the effect that we must spend enough to do the job, so long as that's possible without completely wrecking our economy. And, of course, if we get to the type war that they're talking about, the latter qualification has to go out the window because we have to spend enough to do the job in that case, regardless of the consequences.
You mean there's more than one kind of a war?
There certainly is. My main difference of opinion with the predecessors on this program is that I think we're already in the most important phase of this war. We're in this bloodless economic war, propaganda war, which in my opinion we must win. A military war would create such disastrous chaos in this country that as I see it, it's entirely possible that the communistic ideology might thrive despite everything we can do. Our stakes are so high that it therefore follows that we simply must do the job in this bloodless economic propaganda war, of which we're already a very definite part.
Would you be willing then to overlook the universal military training and armament angle?
I'm still opposed to universal military training. I am not opposed to selective service as I understand it. I see no fault to find with the program that Secretary Forrestal has outlined, except for that particular reference that he made to universal military training.
Well, now,
Our first line of defense, Harry, is this economic system, this structure that we have here in our own country. We must continue to put all the emphasis on this job of, first of all, creating an example to the rest of the world, and secondly, stepping up our own productive machinery to the very maximum so that we can give every possible necessary assistance to those countries and the rest of the world that have demonstrated a will to win.
Are you willing to spend money for armaments now?
I certainly am. I think we must spend money for armaments in reasonable amount. I'm just saying that I want the emphasis on this Economic Cooperation Administration program, about which I'm even more enthusiastic than ever because of the able leader that's been chosen in the person of Paul Hoffman.
You think he's the man to do the job?
I do. I sincerely hope that he'll be given the privilege of doing it without interference from the State Department or any place else, because I have confidence in him. I believe America does.
Well, now, getting back to how much money we should spend, Mr. Newsom, do you think that we should spend as much on armaments now as Forrestal recommends?
Yes. I'm inclined to think that that's a sound expenditure. I still believe that our economy can support this economic warfare that I'm talking about, though, in addition to the military expenditures as they've been outlined. I want to hasten to say that this military program the Secretary Forrestal outlined, in my opinion, is absolutely necessary, for the most part, if we're going to demonstrate our determination to support not only the economic warfare program that I'm talking about, but to support the United Nations in the final analysis and support this Western Union in Europe.
But all the way through, you're thinking of two phases of warfare, the economic warfare and the preparedness in a military way.
Yes. Don't let us ever forget for a moment that the world's greatest potential in a war-productive machine is to be found in Western Europe and chiefly in Western Germany outside of the United States. I mean, we're first and that area is second.
So we have to keep spending our money in two ways, for defense in a military way and in this economic cooperation program. Is that right?
That's right. And let me emphasize this one fact. This social revolution that's been taking place in the world for all this period of time, perhaps 100 years, is very definitely the type thing that we can't stop. We probably shouldn't stop it if we wanted to. We must direct it to the greatest production that's possible. And in my opinion, that means our kind of an economy.
All right there, Dwight, you have the opinions of Herschel D. Newsom, master of the Indiana Grange, and now we're returning you from Indianapolis to Dwight Cook in Washington.
You know, farmers are supposed to be traditionally isolationists, and especially isolationists out in the Middle West, of which Indianapolis is a part. You can judge for yourself in terms of what the master of the Indiana Grange had to say, whether you think American farmers are isolationists in any sense today. Now, as we do a little more pulling together this cross-section of the USA on money for defense, we'll hear next from a great nonpartisan organization of our neighbors, which includes labor, business, and farming representatives, the National Planning Association. We'll go south to hear from their spokesman and their research director down to Durham, North Carolina, where Frank Jarman of WDNC has his questions already, so okay, Frank.
Dwight, I'm happy to be questioning Dr. Calvin B. Hoover on this very timely and important subject. Dr. Hoover is Director of Research of Natural Planning Association for the South, and he's head of the Economic Department of Duke University here in Durham, and a member of the Harriman Committee on European Aid. You know, it seems to me that most of our speakers this afternoon have agreed on most of the points brought to light. So let's find out how Dr. Hoover feels about the matter.
I am amazed and deeply glad that I am in agreement with all the speakers who have spoken up till now. I think we feel basically the same about money for defense. In particular, our last speaker, he referred to the Economic Cooperation Agency under Paul Hoffman, for which I am now working. And I couldn't overemphasize his remarks. And I would like to say also that, just as he did, that far from being any conflict between national defense and European aid, the two are absolutely complementary.
Now, on what scale does money for defense need to be provided, Dr. Hoover? I mean, is it a question of just another billion or two in total budget of some $40 million, or are the amounts required large enough to change the whole financial and the whole economic picture?
The funds needed are very large, enough to affect our economic and financial system very profoundly. I think the best answer is to ask another question. Suppose in 1939 or 1940 or early 1941, we had known that Pearl Harbor was going to happen. What would have been the scale of our preparation then? How much money for defense would we have provided? Well, our problem now is to provide the kind of national defense that'll prevent a Pearl Harbor or a Bataan from happening.
What defense need do you think that they are for which funds have not yet been asked for by President Truman?
Well, as you know, funds have been asked for universal military training and for selective service and for bringing our forces up to their authorized strength. But there are a number of things that have not been covered. One of them, of course, is raising our air power from 55 groups to 70. I think that needs to be done very badly, and it needs to be done as fast as it possibly can. In the beginning, it would require, no doubt, at least $2.5 billion for that item alone. Probably that sum would be required even in the first year. There's a whole series of other things. A radar warning system for the North American continent. In addition to that, arms for Western Europe, the countries which are going to stand with us in resisting Soviet aggression. That's not a complete list, and perhaps later we can refer to still others.
Well, does this mean, Dr. Huber, that money for defense on the scale which would wipe out the recent tax reduction?
I think it does mean that. Indeed, I think we should be increasing taxes rather than reducing them. Of course, the reduction of taxes is now under the bridge. It's something that's happened. But I think it quite likely that in the future we will have to raise them again, and in the not very distant future.
And do you think that the crisis is as serious as President Truman stated, and do you think that money for defense is needed in the amounts as great or greater than those asked for by President Truman in his recent special message to Congress?
I'm sure the crisis is as grave, and I would even say graver, than President Truman, Secretary Marshall, and Defense Secretary Forrestal have stated. And I think the needs are substantially greater than have yet been called to the attention of Congress.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Huber. I wish we could go on. You said you had a few more things that you'd like to tell us about, but our time's just about up. And that, Dwight, is the way that the National Planning Association views the question of money for defense.
Well, I suppose if you started to sum this up, the first thing you'd sum it up with is a phrase, at least I would, that I used a few minutes ago, and that is, what should we spend for national defense? The works. And when you think of what's been going on in this one radio program this afternoon, I just think it might send a few chills down the backs of people who think the American people are sort of a vague, spineless group who don't know the score anywhere in the world. Because remember, everyone who was on today's cross-section spoke for a great national organization of our neighbors. No one of them had any idea what anyone else on the program was going to say, and each one of our guests spoke purely extemporaneously and informally to the frank and open and very direct questions which our interviewers around the country asked them. The net result, as we all heard as it came by our ears, is a very unanimous stand in terms of all the organizations concerned in this program on a whole group of vitally important American problems. They all agree that the situation is extremely serious. They all agree that we must have enough spent to do the job, whatever it costs. And they all admit that at this present time, the military has got to decide how much that will be. They all stress that spending now will mean saving later. They all agree that we need a larger Air Force. And they all say that we must have whatever controls are necessary, industrial, labor, or what have you. And just to bring it right back in our own laps, Mr. Hoover, who's a financial expert, among other things, reminded us just before we came back to Washington that we also are probably going to need to have higher taxes, and it's going to cost us all more to do what they all agree we must do, come what may. Next week, we're going to turn to a purely domestic issue and take up the question of the Taft-Hartley Act and strikes. We'll have representatives of labor and business at that time to discuss this act and tell us why they think it's good or bad and contributing towards strikes or keeping from it. I hope you'll want to be back with us next week at the same time for that cross-section.
Listen in again at the same time next Saturday when Dwight Cook takes you on another cross-section of the USA. This time on what official spokesmen of the country's largest national organizations in business and labor have to say about the Taft-Hartley Act and strikes. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.